You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures. Today on Sustainable Futures, we'll have our feature interview with Laura Track from the Pivot Legal Society about Olympic legal observers.
The free speech zone was a very poor choice of words on the part of the integrated security officials because, of course, Canada is a free speech zone.
Yes.
There is nowhere where free speech is allowed and then isn't allowed. And so the idea of creating places where protesters have to go if they want to protest just doesn't fit with our Charter of Rights and Freedoms and our constitutional protections to the rights to protest and to assemble and to speak freely.
We'll also have a short clip from a protest that happened about the Gateway Project here in Vancouver on December 7th, the first day of the Copenhagen Climate Talks. I'm Ryan Fletcher. You're listening to Sustainable Futures. Good afternoon, listeners. This is Sustainable Futures. On the episode today, we're going to be talking about free speech and demonstrations and our right to it and how that's all going these days. So the feature interview, which we will begin with, is with Laura Track of the Pivot Legal Society about a program they have called Olympic Legal Observers. This is something that you can do if you wish during the Olympics that are happening here in Vancouver in February. So in the interview, she'll be talking about the Pivot Legal Society as well as this initiative. Without further introduction, here is my official introduction to Laura Track. So this is Ryan Fletcher from Sustainable Futures, and I'm interviewing Laura Track of the Pivot Legal Society, and we're going to be talking about the Pivot Legal Society and the Olympic Games Legal Observers. First of all, what is the Pivot Legal Society? And also, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. The Pivot Legal Society is a nonprofit legal advocacy organization doing work in the downtown east side. And our mandate is to take a strategic approach to law reform by bringing strategic litigation cases forward, engaging in advocacy and lobbying around necessary law reform, and doing legal education for the community. And this legal observer training really fits into our legal education mandate to ensure that people are prepared for the Olympic Games and that we have eyes and ears on the streets during the games to ensure that people's legal rights are respected and protected.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are the legal observers?
The legal observers will be volunteers who will be on the streets during the games monitoring protests, monitoring access to venues, and just simply recording their observations in a neutral and objective way so that those observations can be used in the future. Potentially, their observations may form the basis for court challenges or help provide defense for protesters or other people who are arrested or otherwise impacted by security officials during the games.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be placed into a report, a sort of analysis of how security operations worked or didn't work during the games that can be provided to governments to suggest needed law reforms, and that can also be provided to future host cities so that they can learn from hopefully our successes as well as things that don't go well in Vancouver to avoid making the same mistakes.
Is there a history from different Olympic Games where this kind of thing has been needed?
Legal observers, to our knowledge, have never been used before in Canada. And I don't believe they've been used in other Olympic situations before. So this is quite a new initiative, although legal observers have been trained and used in other events. For example, legal observers participated at the Republican National Convention last year and, in fact, were targeted by security officials for their role. So part of the training legal observers will receive if they volunteer for this program is some awareness around that and how to avoid becoming themselves targets of police attention and how to sort of stay out of the fray and maintain their role as observers, as monitors who are outside of protest activities.
Is there going to be any kind of identifying uniform?
Yes. All legal observers will be outfitted with a very bright orange T-shirt that will clearly identify them as legal observers. We've done our best throughout this process to be as transparent as possible with the police and with security forces who will be on the ground during the Olympic Games, because we really don't want the Olympic observers to become the focus of police. We want their neutrality and their objectivity to be respected. We want police to know what their training entails, and we want the police to be well aware that legal observers have been trained not to get involved in protests. If a legal observer feels they simply have to get involved in a situation that they're witnessing, they're instructed to remove their legal observer T-shirt and to sort of end their role as a legal observer if they decide to transition into another role. So we're hoping that by being this transparent and ensuring that the police are well aware of our plans and that the observers are easily identifiable in the crowd, that that they will be left alone.
Now, the police are in some form the actual legal observers. So how do they feel about this third tier coming in to observe them?
What they've said is that they actually welcome our presence and that they have no problem with us being around. And in fact, PIVOT and the BC Civil Liberties Association, who is our partner on this initiative, we've actually trained members of the Olympic Integrated Security Unit, the security officials for the Olympics. They've been provided with the exact same training that legal observers have been provided, again, just in an effort to be totally transparent and clear about what the role is for these legal observers. And I think that having those eyes and ears on the streets is a good thing for everyone. It can provide needed evidence after the fact, and I think that legal observers also provide a bit of a deterrent effect, that when police know that people are there observing, hopefully with cameras and video cameras, that it can mitigate some of the actions that might otherwise be taken.
Will there be an ability to bring cameras and video cameras throughout the whole, all of the sites?
The legal observers were working to secure enough funding to allow us to provide every observer or observer team. The observers will go out in pairs, and ideally every team will have some way of documenting what they're seeing, either still cameras or video cameras. And we would welcome any donations of used equipment that people no longer have a need for. If they would like to donate to the observer program, we would certainly welcome that equipment.
Okay. So I'm guessing then that you're anticipating there to be a lot of protest. Is there a general feeling that there's going to be a lot?
Well, it's difficult to know exactly what to expect, but I anticipate that there will be protests during the Olympic Games. The Olympics provide an excellent forum for groups to raise issues of concern to them. There will be a significant media presence for the Games, and the Games really bring into focus a lot of the social issues, Indigenous issues, issues of poverty and homelessness that are affecting our city. And I definitely feel pretty confident in saying that I expect people will be demonstrating and speaking out about these issues of concern to them.
In addition to the police, is there not also going to be a lot of military?
The Integrated Security Unit has regular Vancouver Police Department forces, RCMP forces that they're bringing in from across the country, private security guards, and Canadian military as well. The sort of breakdown of the different groups' role is the Vancouver Police Department will be responsible for policing the city. Mm-hmm. The RCMP will be working inside venue areas, and I'm told that private security guards will just be working at the access points to venues, doing kind of airport-style security as people come into Olympic events. Mm-hmm. And the military, we're told, will not be patrolling the streets of Vancouver, but will be providing support roles in other ways. But indeed, there will be a significant security presence. This is the largest peacetime security operation in Canadian history, and there will be over 15,000 security people from various agencies, RCMP, military, private security, that will be here for the Olympic Games.
Mm-hmm. So everybody's aware of you. Is that correct? Like the military as well and the private security? Is that?
We've done our very best to make sure that everybody is well aware of the program. We've advertised it widely, and like I said, we actually provided our training to some officials of the ISU, so everyone should be well aware of what we're doing and what we're going to look like in our orange T-shirts, and they should be well aware that we're providing training to people, letting them know that their role is not to engage with protesters, it's not to provide legal advice, it's just simply to monitor and observe. And so people are welcome to participate in the program, whether they have any legal training or not, even whether they are comfortable being in protest areas. We also have roles for people in offices doing logistics and data entry and all kinds of responsibilities and duties for people who don't feel comfortable being out on the streets. We certainly acknowledge that, because there is a potential that protests during the Games could become unsafe. The security officials for the Olympics have been specifically and directly asked if they would rule out the use of agent provocateur, which your listeners might remember from Montebello. Two or three police officers were used to go into the crowd of protesters, peaceful protesters, and instigate violence and incite violence amongst the crowd. One was carrying a rock. They were trying to get people to react and to use that as a way of justifying a police crackdown. And the BC Civil Liberties asked the ISU if they... it's quite a terrible tactic and has the effect of making protest unsafe thanks to police officers coming in and taking these actions. And the BC Civil Liberties specifically asked the ISU if they would please guarantee that they wouldn't use such a misguided tactic during the Olympic Games, and they wouldn't provide that assurance, which causes serious concern that indeed they will use agent provocateur and themselves then contribute to a lack of safety in protest areas.
So that's not very transparent.
It's not. It's not. And the whole process around security planning and the protection of civil liberties has really followed that trend of a real lack of transparency. There were calls early as 2003 and even before Vancouver was awarded the Olympic Games to ensure that civil society organizations, civil liberties advocates were invited to participate in consultations around security plans before the Games. And those consultations just never happened. Last March, we were finally able to convince representatives from the Integrated Security Unit to at least come to the Downtown East Side and make a presentation about security plans. we had no illusions that this was a true consultation in a sense of there being a give and take and a sort of listening from all sides and participation in security plans, but it was at least a useful event in terms of providing information to the community, and a number of things of concern were raised at that meeting, but also I think a number of reassurances were given in terms of what the security impacts would likely be, particularly on the downtown East Side neighborhood, which is where Pivot is located and where we focus our work, and where an Olympic corridor, an Olympic lane, is going to be running straight through the heart of the community. Hastings Street is going to be a six-lane Olympic superhighway, and that's definitely going to have some impacts on people's mobility and pedestrian safety and those kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how does someone become a legal observer?
People can become a legal observer by checking out the BC Civil Liberties or the Pivot website and by emailing shannon@bccla.org. And that's how people can register to become a legal observer. The remaining scheduled training session is December 6th. So not this coming Sunday, but next Sunday. I believe that training session is full, and we hope to announce additional training sessions shortly because the demand for these trainings has far exceeded our expectations. When we first launched the program, we were estimating training maybe 100 volunteers between September and the time of the games, and had three of our four planned sessions, and we've already trained over 200 people. Wow. So it's been a fantastic response, and people are really keen to participate and to do what they can to ensure that security is held accountable during the Olympics.
Well, I can see it, too, is that in addition to being applied to the Olympics, for the lay person, it's also a chance to learn the law a little bit.
A little bit. We try to be clear that it's not a legal advice seminar and that we need to be careful about providing just legal information, and that as situations arise, people may need more specific legal advice. And because we just are so unsure of what to expect during the games and what to expect from police and security, we just don't know how people are going to be treated, how many arrests there are likely to be, and so we feel the need to warn people that while we'll make sure that we have a lawyer available to do bail hearings and get them out of jail if they do happen to be arrested, that beyond that, we're simply unable at this point to guarantee legal representation to take their cases through court. So it's something we feel the need to be really clear about. There are some risks to participating in the program. Of course, we hope that things will go smoothly. In fact, we hope the legal observers will be bored during the Olympics.
That would be a good thing.
Stand around and enjoy people exercising their right to free speech, and they'll watch the police respecting that right as well.
Uh-huh.
So we'll keep our fingers crossed.
Okay. And there's also community media initiative happening during the Olympics. Is there any kind of work alongside with that group? Do you know about that group?
A community media group. I don't think I'm familiar with that. Pivot is planning our communication strategy for the Olympics, and we think that having a designated information feed, maybe a blog or something like that, to keep people informed about how things are going will be important, but we haven't partnered with any other organizations on that as of yet.
Okay. Well, I'll be sure to make them aware.
Great.
So you mentioned we kind of started on this answer. What kind of things do people learn when they go to legal observer training?
One of the main things we talk about is how to take useful notes, how to ensure that your notes record as sort of objectively as possible what it is that you're witnessing. So we do role plays and we have practice sessions on how to get as much detail in, what kinds of details are important, location, the security person's uniform to help us identify them as VPD or private security, what private security company they might be from, all of those important details about monitoring a situation. We also give them a list of useful equipment to have in addition to a video camera and a notepad and pens, of course. We also suggest that people bring goggles or a scuba mask in case tear gas is used. Mm-hmm. We also suggest a bandana soaked in water and held in a plastic bag can be useful if those kinds of tools, pepper spray, are used against protesters. Things like quarters or cell phones and your lawyer's phone number, all of these kinds of necessities. Mm-hmm. And then we talk a little bit about how to ensure that your recordings aren't confiscated by the police, because that's a real concern, that police will seize people's notes or their video recordings. And we give people a little bit of a brief or advisory on the law around that. And the police are entitled to take materials like that if they believe you're likely to destroy those materials or that they won't be able to find you again and take the materials lawfully following a warrant. And this is part of our rationale for ensuring that the legal observer process is as transparent as possible. We want the police to be very well advised that people are recording this information and handing it over to the Civil Liberties Association and Pivot Legal, and that those documents and those video recordings will be available to the police if they legitimately require them and produce a search warrant, a court-ordered warrant, for us to hand them over, and we'll happily do that. So we'd really like to avoid the situation where observers are stripped of their materials at the scene and ensure police know that they'll be able to get access to those materials in the future with a warrant if they need them.
What is the general atmosphere when these classes take place? Do people become fearful, or is there a lot of tension, or is it how are people feeling about this?
I think people are feeling glad to know that there's something they can do. I hear a lot of sort of surprise and shock and a little bit of outrage that we're spending close to $1 billion on security operations, and it just sort of raises the question for people, what are they spending all this money on? What are they really worried about, and what kinds of steps are they going to take against protesters in order to justify this kind of expenditure? So,
and a lack of transparency is even more concerning.
Exactly. That's a big part of it as well. So I don't sense a lot of fear arising during the training sessions, which is a real testament to the people that get involved, because there are definitely risks involved in participating in the program, but mostly people are just interested and engaged and really glad to be able to help out.
Mm-hmm. What happens if something is observed that is illegal?
We're working to establish a rapid response network. So if an observer finds himself in the midst of something serious, we want them to be able to call or text or tweet. We're still figuring out exactly what it's going to look like to alert the sort of legal observer hub, if you will, the main office. And so that we'll be able to send additional observers out to the event, and so that we'll know what's going on and that we can take appropriate steps. And if arrests happen, then people's notes will be useful to any defense counsel that's hired on to assist those people. And again, we're planning to produce a final report after the Olympic Games, kind of looking at how the security operations really played out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And where will the observers be? Is there going to be pre-planned points, or are they just going to be wandering on their own?
Yeah, we'll definitely have observers near the venues to monitor searches and other actions that are taken at access points to venues and celebration sites, the pedestrian corridors and sort of main Olympic areas in the downtown core. We also expect to be advised of protests when they're happening, maybe even before they happen. And so we'll most certainly have legal observers attend any protests that we get wind of.
Right. Okay. My mind is just wandering a little bit, and I'm thinking now, because I almost took part in something once where there was an Olympic protest, and the people that were there were writing things on their own body, because that was like the best way to take notes, because they can't be... Unless, I mean, someone wants to go to very extreme measures, those can't be removed.
Right.
However, I didn't take part because I could see the people in that group were quite militant and they were looking for trouble rather than being sort of, I think there is a certain segment of the anti-Olympic people that are a bit extremist. I wonder if there's any kind of, I guess, what are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, I think that, like I said, the legal observers are advised not to get involved in any kind of confrontation and to put their own safety first. If they feel like a situation is getting out of hand and they're simply not comfortable staying, then always their safety comes first and they need to do what they need to do to ensure their own safety, and nobody should be putting their safety in jeopardy to take notes about what's happening. And it is possible that certain events will get out of hand, that protesters may engage in violent tactics, and that the police may engage in violent tactics right back. And again, the Agent Provocateur example is a really troubling one. So for as far as the observers go, we're advising them to focus their attention on the police and how the police interact, but as part of their objective reporting, they'll also be recording the behavior and the tactics of protesters as well, and all of that will inform the steps taken.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because the nature of conflict is escalating fear on both sides, and there are certain personalities that can create that on either side. And yeah, this provocateur thing is very interesting.
It really is.
Yeah. You're listening to an interview with Laura Track of the Pivot Legal Society about Olympic legal observers on Sustainable Futures of CJSF 90.1 FM. So the free speech zones, could you kind of outline what these free speech zones are?
Well, the free speech zone was a very poor choice of words on the part of the integrated security officials because, of course, Canada is a free speech zone.
Yes,
there is nowhere where free speech is allowed and then isn't allowed. And so the idea of creating places where protesters have to go if they want to protest just doesn't fit with our Charter of Rights and Freedoms and our constitutional protections to the rights to protest and to assemble and to speak freely. But what these are is protest areas that the Integrated Security Unit has said it will be making available in the city. And those haven't been announced yet, which is strange, but I've heard rumors that the Vancouver Art Gallery will be one of the protest zones. But the official line from the ISU and the VPD is that no one will be forced to protest in those areas. So they've acknowledged that, in fact, all of Canada is a protest zone and people are free to protest in public space, and there is nothing illegal about that. But what they now say about the protest areas is that, well, these will be designated areas, they'll be safe, they'll be visible, and people can protest there if they want to. So it'll be interesting to see if those zones are even used, or if people just make use of their constitutional rights to protest anywhere they like.
You gotta wonder why they're even bothering, because I think protesters are smart enough to know which zones are the best zones.
I think so. I think so, too. I think that the reason they've offered these spaces up is from recommendations coming out of the APEC protests back in, 1997 at UBC, where protesters were restricted in where they could protest to places that were miles away from where any of the visiting officials would see them, and sort of undermined the whole point of protesting Indonesian dictators coming to UBC when they couldn't be seen at all. And so one of the recommendations coming out of a report on that event was that people be provided with a visible place where they can protest.
Yeah, that's kind of what my vision has been, is that there's going to be certain areas where the world media will travel and get their picture of the Olympics, and that's going to be, I can see it being very controlled so that they'll get the exact picture that Van Alk wants them to have.
Yeah.
So the protest zones will be, I anticipate, out of there. It's very interesting. This is all very interesting. Yeah.
Indeed. I mean, it's such a big event, the Olympics, and it brings thousands of tourists and tons of international media, and the spotlight really will be on Vancouver for a good three-week period, and people are really asking the question, you know, what kind of face do we want to show the world? Do we want to show the world a police state that doesn't respect people's rights to freedom of speech, that cracks down on protesters, that removes homeless people off the streets and displaces them against their will? Or do we want to show a city with its problems, with its issues, but one that's committed to democratic principles and maintaining people's rights?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or do you want to represent Canada as a great place that is the myth that's still out there in the world? Or do you want to outline what the Olympics does to a city?
A very interesting question, and I really do hope that story is told, and we'll be counting on, you know, small and independent media outlets, I think, to do the heavy lifting in terms of sharing that story with the world.
Okay. So this is kind of changing the track of the conversation a little bit, but is it legal for VANOC and the City of Vancouver to suppress the opinions of Vancouver residents?
Most definitely not. Suppressing the right to free speech. Is a violation of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is part of our Constitution and the highest law of the land. And from my perspective, any attempts to restrict political speech, to restrict critique of the games, is unconstitutional and a very problematic exercise of authority.
So what kind of defense is there for that?
Well, I think the best defense is this law that we have as part of our Constitution, the Charter of Rights, that very clearly protects freedom of expression as a fundamental freedom to which all Canadians are entitled.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk about regarding the Olympic Games legal observers?
I don't think specifically about the observers. Maybe I could just say a word about the Assistance to Shelter Act.
Sure.
So the Assistance to Shelter Act just passed third reading in the legislature, and this is a law that will allow the police to use force to take homeless people into shelters against their will.
Uh-huh.
Whether they want to go or not, they can be forced inside by police during the games. And this law represents, really, I think, most advocates' worst fear. We wondered about this. We thought about how they were going to sweep the streets for the Olympic Games and get rid of the visible signs of poverty that Vancouver has on every street throughout the city. Mm-hmm. And over, we were promised that there were no plans to sweep the streets. Nobody wanted to criminalize the homeless, and people would be left to go about their lives, despite the fact that thousands of tourists and international media were coming to the city. And here we are, some 80-odd days before the Olympic Games, and this law has just been rammed through the provincial government that allows exactly what we feared. It allows the police to take homeless people off of Robson Street, off of Granville Street, out of the places where tourists are likely to be, and to force them into shelters who knows where. There's no restriction in the law on where people can be taken to. Mm-hmm. They'll be taken to a shelter, most of which are full almost all the time, and they'll be dropped off there and left to fend for themselves miles away from the place that's familiar to them. I think that this law is directly related to the Olympic Games and gives the police this tool to act during the games to remove homeless people from the streets. It's a real concern. It's another constitutional problem from my perspective. I think that the law is a gross violation of people's rights not to be arbitrarily detained by police, but nevertheless, it will be enforced until it's challenged and brought down by the courts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to wonder, too, what does that say about the basic freedoms of anybody, not just the homeless? This is a bad precedent to be putting out there.
It really is. It really is. I mean, the police have tools available to them already to take people with mental illness who present a danger to themselves or to others. and to take them against their will to psychiatric facilities or mental health accommodations. And this law goes so much further than that to target people without mental illness who are making a free choice to remain outside. Uh-huh. And I think you're right that it does really raise questions about the rights and freedoms of all people when this law can be applied to the homeless in this way.
And how can they determine someone is homeless?
That's a good question. I think that's the problem with using the police to do this kind of outreach work. If we were instead empowering and funding shelter workers and outreach workers who have established relationships of trust and friendship with people who are homeless, then we would know who's homeless and who's in distress and who is in an unsafe situation and needs to come inside. Mm-hmm. The police don't have that kind of training, and they definitely don't have that kind of credibility with people who are homeless. And so using the police to help bring people inside as a way of contributing to people's safety and security is just very much the wrong way to go about it.
Mm. I'd feel more safe in a place where the homeless were allowed to go myself.
Exactly.
All right. I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk more about the Pivot Legal Society. I've not covered that on this show, and it's a very busy organization, so I'll give you an open place to talk more about the Legal Society.
Okay, that would be great. So Pivot Legal Society has been around since the early 2000s, and the way we started out was through an observation by our now executive director, John Richardson, when he was working near to the downtown east side, that it seemed like all of the rights and protections people have that he was learning about in law school didn't exist in the downtown east side. And he would watch the way the police interacted with people on the streets, and he just found that people's protections against arbitrary detentions or searches, illegal arrests, their right to be informed of, their right to counsel, none of these were really being offered to the people who live down here. It was like a sort of different legal world existed in this neighborhood. And that motivated him to use his legal skills and training and law degree to start Pivot Legal Society as a campaigning organization dedicated to advancing the interests and improving the lives of some of our most marginalized and vulnerable citizens here in the downtown east side. And so Pivot started with a policing campaign. And the model that we used was one actually first used by Mahatma Gandhi. And he took affidavits, basically stories in a legal document format, from people about their experiences with the police. He set up at the corner of Main and Hastings with a laptop and a portable printer plugged into a car battery to charge it. And he sat out there and collected dozens and dozens and dozens of affidavits from people alleging all kinds of things, gross police misconduct, abuse, violence, all sorts of issues arose out of those stories. And those stories formed the basis of a mass complaint to the Police Complaints Commission, alleging serious misconduct on the part of the VPD. And that really was the springboard for what Pivot has become. And it fed into the second campaign issue that Pivot took on, which was campaigning around the laws that criminalize adult sex work. What became really clear as John and other volunteers collected affidavits about policing was that women had very particular issues and experiences when they were dealing with the police. And what Pivot heard over and over and over again was that the laws that criminalize communicating for the purpose of prostitution or that criminalize working inside made it very, very dangerous for women to engage in the trade and made their lives vastly more unsafe because they would move to less visible, more marginal, darker areas of the city where police were unlikely to see them, and they were disappearing and they were turning up dead on pig farms.
Right.
And so that provided the impetus for Pivot launching its sex work campaign, and the main goal of that campaign has been the decriminalization of the sex trade in order to help ensure people's safety as they engage in that trade. And so a court challenge is proceeding through the courts right now on those laws. The housing and homelessness campaign was really the next campaign area that Pivot identified, and the need for that was just so clear. It was just so obvious. Hundreds and hundreds of people sleeping on the streets in this neighborhood.
You just have to go down the street at a certain time of day.
Exactly, exactly. And living in the decrepit hotels throughout the neighborhood, there just was really, the neighborhood was crying out for systemic law reform and advocacy around stronger enforcement of building standards laws, residential tenancy laws. And so these are the initiatives that the housing campaign has taken on.
I just want to share with the audience my first experience of the downtown east side. I was new to Vancouver, and I was just bicycling down Hastings to explore Hastings at about sunset. And I found myself, it was so thick with people that were homeless that I couldn't even bicycle through.
Wow.
Yeah. And that was 4 years ago. So it's a lot worse now. So
amazing.
Think of the impression that made on me.
Yeah. And it's sort of interesting to think the impression it's going to make on the thousands of people who are here in February and March for the Olympics and Paralympics. But it's quite shocking, and the problem hasn't gotten better, which is, it's frustrating when, you know, you're an organization that has been working on these issues for so long to see people continue to suffer, to see affordable housing continue to actually be lost in this neighborhood without a corresponding impetus on government to build new affordable housing. And when you see homeless rates increase the way they have over the last several years, it can be really disheartening. And to try to counteract some of that doom and gloom, and also to put the word out there that we have the solutions to homelessness, Pivot has just launched a new campaign called Homelessness is Over If You Want It.
Yeah, that's a good one.
We kind of like that. It's a play on John Lennon and Yoko Ono's War is Over If You Want It, that they were plastering up around various American cities during the Vietnam War, and really inviting people to envision a future where homelessness is over. Mm-hmm. Homelessness can be over if we want it, if we demand it, if we elect governments who are willing to make it happen. And so we've been rolling out a series of initiatives and actions that people can take. And we have a website, it's homelessnessisover.ca. We also have a Facebook fan page if people are interested in checking that out. And on the website, people can send a postcard to the minister in Ottawa responsible for housing, Diane Finley, and ask her to do her job and implement a national housing strategy to ensure that everyone has a safe place to live. They can also watch our just-released video newscast announcing the story that Vancouver has ended homelessness and housed the last homeless person in the Kansas Hotel, a new hotel. And again, it's just a visioning exercise in a way of imagining what the world would look like without homelessness, and then inviting people to take action to make it happen. So at the end of the video, people are invited to send a message to the BC Housing Minister, Rich Coleman, asking him to spend the $250 million he has sitting in the bank right now in what's called a housing endowment fund, and which is just sitting there and not being used to build housing, which would be a much more useful thing it could be doing.
Seems appropriate.
Yeah, it does seem appropriate, I think, to spend the housing endowment fund on some housing. So people can click and send a message really easily to the minister to say that having it sitting in the bank is not the most useful thing. Let's spend it and get some housing in the ground. And there are other things that people can do. They can make their own video answering the question, why end homelessness? Mm-hmm. And we're going to run a contest. I'm looking for the best answer to that question and the best video. Mm-hmm. We'll have some voting on the top contenders, and we've made a commitment to do everything in our power to ensure that the best video gets seen by Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Mm-hmm. We're still brainstorming exactly how we're going to make that happen, but we're committed to making sure that he has the opportunity to see it.
I'm going to go back on the track at the beginning of this interview because something just occurred to me.
Sure.
Okay. On the front page of the paper recently, I don't know if it was today's paper, but there's an announcement of searchlights going in the West End. Have you read about that?
Are they just the, like, light displays?
Light display, yeah.
Yeah.
How does that affect things? And then the fact that...
Well, you could say maybe, if this was relevant and you can... The spending priorities for the Olympic Games have been pretty mind-boggling. I mean, we are spending $6 billion to bring a three-week party to Vancouver, and this in a province that has the worst child poverty rate in Canada for 6 years running. This in a province with some 15,000 people without a place to live. It seems to me that our priorities are quite skewed when we're spending these kinds of dollars on light shows and convention centers and not spending this money on basic necessities of life for all of the province's residents.
I was very surprised to read about it because at this point, I think everybody knows that they're way, way, way over budget.
Mm-hmm.
And they think somehow someone thinks that we're going to be excited about this light show, which seems actually kind of dumb.
And isn't this supposed to be the Green Games? What kind of energy requirements is that gigantic light show going to have?
I wonder, too, how does it affect people in the sky? Is there going to be, I guess there'd be a lot of plane traffic going through.
Oh, that's an aspect I hadn't thought about.
And then, helicopters, I'm sure there'll be helicopters around doing video cameras and blimps, like the video blimps and all this sort of stuff. Have they really thought about that, or they just wanted to spend their money?
A very good question. I don't know.
Anyway, the asking of questions is becoming out of fashion.
Yeah, seems that way sometimes, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much, Laura Track.
You're very welcome. Great to talk to you.
And what's your website again, just for our listeners?
So the new campaign has its own website, homelessnessisover.ca. And Pivot's website is pivotlegal.org.
Okay.
And that concludes our interview with Laura Track about Olympic Legal Observers. I myself think I'm going to be one of those observers. It sounds like it would be a great way to spend the Olympics as someone who is not particularly excited about what the Olympics is going to be doing to our city. Our city? That's up for question, actually. The next segment is audio from a demonstration I attended on December 7th. What you're going to hear is the official speech that's sort of at the beginning of the demonstration. There was some kerfuffle with the police authorities later in the evening. I will not have that audio for you here on Sustainable Futures, just for you to make note of. And here's the speech and some of the chanting from December 7th.
No longer morally acceptable to me and all the people here to do nothing about the changes to this planet and to the future for my children and my grandchildren, which is going to be absolutely impoverished unless we as a people in Canada and in North America and the world can't fundamentally recognize the crisis that confronts us and to change our habits immediately. What we're looking at here with this reconstruction of this freeway, which should certainly not be expanded during this 10-year period, but the money taken for this kind of expansion used to fundamentally alter the nature of our movement infrastructure, I consider this to be an absurdity. We only have 10, maybe 20 years at the most to get this problem fixed. And if we're not able to do it this generation, the people here who are standing here, whatever age, it's not going to get done. And my kids, and especially my grandkids, and the grandchildren around the world are going to be due for a real shitstorm.
Do it right! Do it now!
A hard rain is going to fall. So I'm here to support the good people here who are
standing in the street and making their insistence that we change now, do it now, known publicly. And I hope that this is the first of many such actions. Very important that this is occurring on the first day of the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference, which we are all depending on. Finally, it's a matter that's extremely shameful. I'm embarrassed for Canada, who has the opportunity to take what had been a good legacy of environmental advancement over the decades to have now become the dirtiest country in the world. Today, Canada had the dubious distinction of being singled out singly as the worst country in its environmental record and the largest foot dragger in the world, largely due to the country's shameful allegiance to the tar sands enterprise.
Shame!
Shame!
Tar sands, as we all know, contribute four times more greenhouse gas per gallon of gasoline than any other petroleum product on the planet.
Dirty!
If your Prius is fueled with tar sands oil, you might as well be driving two Hummers at the same time, because your consequences are about the same. So again, and in conclusion, I just want to say I'm proud to be here supporting this, and I'm honored to have been given this microphone. Thank you very much.
So thank you for listening to this week's episode of Sustainable Futures, and I hope you are enjoying a right to free speech in your life, wherever you may be listening from. This program is every Friday from 3 to 4 on CJSF 90.1 FM. It's also available on the internet, www.cjsf.ca, and also available at one other location, which is www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. I periodically will post previous episodes of Sustainable Futures so you can access any and all of our 48 episodes of Sustainable Futures on that website. All you need to do is type Sustainable Futures in their search bar and you will get it. So once again, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be presenting you with news and activities and information on sustainability around the world and Vancouver and BC to you each week. I'm Ryan Fletcher, and I'm wishing you a sustainable future.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
The introductory music for this program is brought to you by Moira, an excerpt from her song Like a Mountain. The theme music from the band River Tribe, who hails from Australia.